What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Weight Watchers now offers access to affordable GLP-1s. It works for members like...
I'm Haley, and I've lost 100 pounds. Weight Watchers has everything I need, from weight loss medications to nutrition support and help with my side effects. It's all in one place.
Weight Watchers handles the insurance for you and offers affordable cash pay options. With our program, our members are losing more weight with expert nutrition and side effect support.
I'm Mike, and I've lost 135 pounds. Weight Watchers prescribing GLP-1 medications, it's been life-changing.
I'm Sharia, and I lost 80 pounds on Weight Watchers. I realized that it would take more than a prescription to lose weight and feel good on a GLP-1.
Better results, expert support, lose more weight, make it last.
I can't imagine doing a GLP-1 without Weight Watchers.
Get started for as low as $25 at weightwatchers.com/GLP-1.
Medications require eligibility and prescription. Patients on 15 milligrams of tirzepatide had an average of 21% weight loss in a 72-week clinical trial when paired with diet and exercise. First month as low as $25 with a 12-month MedPlus plan. Does not include the cost of GLP-1 medications.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to The Katie Helper Show, and I'm your host, Katie Helper. If you like the show, please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. To support the show, visit patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show, where for just $1 a month, you can help make the show happen. And for $5 a month, you'll qualify for great bonus content, including alternative podcast feed and rarely seen clips that aired on our live shows. Welcome, Jan. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. So you issued an appeal for peace against the war. You did this from the Czech Republic. I wanted to know why you did that and what your thoughts are on the war, both how it started, but also how it can be stopped.
Yeah, to put it in a context, early this year, in January, with several colleagues of mine, we set up a peace initiative called Peace and Justice. So in the name of this initiative, we made an appeal to our government, but also other governments, to stop sending arms to Ukraine, because we believe that sending weapons only prolongs the war. And we asked in this appeal for an immediate ceasefire and opening of these negotiations, diplomatic solution. Obviously, it's a controversial issue, and we were aware from the very beginning that many people will disagree, in particular with the issue of ceasefire, because even some of our colleagues and members of parliament argued that a ceasefire will only help the Russian side, because if the West stops sending arms and weapons to Ukraine, Ukraine will be militarily defeated by Russia. I think that it's a dangerous misinterpretation of our call. We made it very clear from the very beginning that any ceasefire will have to be observed by both sides. One side in ceasefire will not be able to work. And only a ceasefire which is observed and negotiated and agreed upon by both sides will, in our opinion, create sufficient space for diplomats to replace generals and soldiers, sit around the table and begin negotiations about a peaceful solution to this conflict. We have agreed even with some American experts, including U.S. General Mark Milley, that there is no military solution. Neither side is able to militarily, decisively defeat the other. And sending arms to Ukraine will only prolong the war lead to greater devastation of the country, to more people being killed, and it will not bring about end of the war and end of the suffering, which is why we stress that, although we understand that negotiations are difficult, but a ceasefire is extremely necessary to be agreed upon as soon as possible, because every day the war continues, thousands of people on both sides are being killed. So this is our argument. The argument also is that, obviously so much bloodshed has been, and so much hatred that there is no possibility, or at least we don't believe there is a possibility for both sides to agree on a ceasefire. There would have to be a powerful intermediary. There are already some precedents, like already on 8th of February last year, before the war started, French President Macron agreed with both President Putin and President Zelensky to sign an agreement on neutrality of Ukraine. But the following day, President Zelensky changed his mind after we understand talking to his American friends. In March, in Istanbul, with the help of the Turkish President Erdogan and the UN, once again, an agreement was reached on neutrality. And again, when Zelensky returned to Kiev, he changed his mind following a visit by the then British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who asked him to continue to fight with the full support of President Biden of the United States. So we know it is difficult, and therefore we hope that a powerful group of intermediaries will step in and arrange for the ceasefire and the diplomatic talks. At the moment, we believe that such a group of intermediaries will be almost certainly led by China, will be joined by the Brazilian President Lula da Silva, who already made clear that he supports such a solution. And then once these two important actors will make their position clear, I think it will be joined by Turkey, France, Germany, and some others. And obviously, any agreement would have to be guaranteed and supervised, in my opinion, by United Nations. The negotiations will be long, painful, and difficult. Both sides will have to make some concessions, and this is not going to be easy. I do believe that despite the verbal declarations of NATO leaders, including top American politicians, that the collective West should support Ukraine as long as it takes, or until final victory, as President Zelensky frequently uses that term, I think that they know that this is nonsense, that this is non-realistic. That's why I think they are looking for an improvement on the battlefield. I think they were hoping that the current Ukrainian offensive will be more successful than it is, then it would improve the position of the Ukraine army and therefore create a better position for the negotiations. I think that everybody, if they admit it publicly or not, everybody is convinced that there is no other solution but diplomatic solution. But both sides are trying to work or manipulate, create a situation which will be more advantageous to them for the negotiations. Because obviously each side wants to negotiate from the position of strength. In fact, that will not happen. I do believe that the intermediaries should come with some proposals, constructive proposals, which may be acceptable to both sides. In my opinion, and the opinion of my colleagues here in my in our peace initiative, we believe that the framework would have to be an agreement that Ukraine will not join NATO, because that's a red line for the Russians, and has been since 2007, when President Putin made it clear publicly at international conferences and repeated it many times since then. If it's rational or not, I don't want to comment, but those of us who know Russian history are aware that all Russian leaders, presidents, communist leaders, Tsars before, were always afraid of encirclement. We're always afraid of foreign invasions. As I said, I don't want to comment if it's rational or not, but we have to take it into account that this is how they think. So I fully understood when in 1991, the last Soviet President Gorbachev asked President Bush and Chancellor Kohl that they should promise not to move NATO eastwards if it agrees to withdraw Soviet troops from GDR, from East Germany, which is what they asked him, because they wanted East Germany to be unified with West Germany and to join NATO. And State Secretary James Baker at the time made it very clear that NATO will not move one inch eastwards if we, if I called him. Unfortunately, Gorbachev was, sorry to put it like that, naive enough to believe a spoken word, a spoken promise by top Western leaders, and didn't ask for a binding signed peace agreement. Therefore, we only have recordings, memories of officials who attended those meetings. I've read about 300 pages of them, and I'm absolutely convinced that this is the case, and that unfortunately the West has not fulfilled that promise. Since 1991, NATO has moved closer and closer to Russian borders. If Ukraine will join NATO, that in the Russian eyes would definitely be a security threat. This is a situation in which military conflicts take place. And those in the West who believe that we should fight to the last Ukrainian and send more and more sophisticated weapons to Ukrainians in order to ensure victory of Ukraine, I think naively forget that Russia is still a nuclear superpower. And this is a very risky behavior. In a hypothetical situation, well, for example, with the help of Western weapon, modern weaponry, Ukraine will be on the verge of taking back Crimea, which is extremely important to Russia. I think at that moment, there is no guarantee that President Putin will not resort to the use of, say, tactical nuclear weapon. And then we are on a very slippery slope to a nuclear holocaust, which I believe nobody wants to see. I'm therefore convinced that we should not play with such a risky situation, that we should not even allow this to happen. That's why we are asking for immediate ceasefire and negotiations. I'm absolutely convinced that if the the circumstances are correct, Russia may be prepared to withdraw from some of the territories they now occupy and keep the soldiers on two territories, on Donbas, that is on those two separatist republics, Luhansk and Donetsk, and in Crimea. I can't believe that there is any possibility, even a distant possibility, of Ukraine, if I use the terminology of President Zelensky, liberating Crimea by militarily defeating Russian troops in Crimea. And I think even attempting that is, as I said, risking that President Putin and put in a corner in order to avoid the unthinkable defeat, could resort to the use of nuclear weapon. That's why the slogan used also occasionally by U.S. President that we should support Ukraine as long as it takes, I think is a dangerous approach, which would only result in more and more people being killed, and it will not bring nearer the possibility of sitting down and discussing peace. I also believe that these discussions would have to include the possibility of new referenda to take place, in particular in Donbas and in Crimea, and obviously not under supervision of the Russian army, but under the supervision of the United Nations. And if in such a referenda, majority of the Russian-speaking population in these territories will reject the possibility of being reintegrated into Ukraine, that would have to be respected by the international community, which, in my opinion, unfortunately, sometimes resorts to double standards. What was allowed in Kosovo is not allowed in Caucasian, in Ossetia, in Abkhazia. I remember a long time ago, President Obama, in one speech, in the same breath, praised the principle of self-determination linked to the protest which took place in the Maidan Square in Kiev, which eventually led to the downfall of democratically elected President Yanukovych, and at the same time rejected any application of the principle of self-determination in Crimea. I think the West should agree that principle of self-determination should be respected, should be applied, should be implemented, but there should not be double standards. That undermines the authenticity, that undermines the whole principle as such. So I very much hope that we could recreate the type of international peace movement which I remember from the 70s and 80s. I was then a Czech emigre in the United Kingdom and took active part in the struggle against the installation of cruise and Pershing missiles in Western Europe, and SF-20 Soviet missiles in Eastern Europe. At that time, there was a quite powerful international peace movement. I remember myself working both with the British, the Dutch, the Germans, but also with similar groups in the then Czechoslovakia, Poland, Slovenia. I very much hope that today, and the situation is even more dangerous, we could inspire a number of the national peace groups. And I, a few days ago, attended a peace conference in Ljubljana in Slovenia, and before that in Vienna. So I'm aware that there are a number of peace groups, but they are not properly linked. They don't cooperate. They don't coordinate. They don't yet present unified position, for example, on the need for ceasefire. But I do believe that the more people become aware of the dangers, and I'm very grateful to your program that you are trying to explain this to people, the more people will understand this, the greater likelihood is that the national peace groups will become international, and then they will get greater clout, and therefore have possibility of applying more pressure on their respective governments to understand that sending weapons to Ukraine will not bring about peace and only prolong the war, and that therefore that the government should cooperate to create, as I said, the group of intermediaries capable of negotiating a peaceful solution to this conflict.
And how would the U.S. wind down the military support?
I don't see any major problem. I mean, the United States is already militarily present in Ukraine. And this, I think, would be an argument of the Russian side that they would like Ukraine not only to guarantee to be neutral, not to join NATO, but not to have foreign military bases and all offensive weapons on its territory. But that has to be part of the negotiations. It's not on me to tell them how to do that. And the parties themselves would have to agree on the actual terms. But if Ukraine is guaranteed a political support, political support of the West, including United States, this, I think, will be more than acceptable to Kiev, that they will have no longer any fear of another Russian invasion. But I think, will be very difficult following the recent summit in Vilnius, NATO summit in Vilnius. There would have to be an explicit statement that Ukraine will join the West. Ukraine will almost certainly in time, join the European Union, will become part of economic, social, and military West, but will not be a member of NATO. That, I think, will be crucial. And I do hope that U.S. politicians will understand that same as they would never accept Mexico to become a member of Warsaw Pact, same as they could not tolerate Soviet missiles in Cuba, they have to understand the way Russia perceives its own security and make at least a certain conciliatory step towards that understanding. And I think embracing Ukraine, guaranteeing their freedom, guaranteeing their democracy, but avoiding a formal membership of NATO is, I think, one step which could open the gate to meaningful negotiations about peace in that region. And, as I said before, no longer applying double standards. Principle of national self-determination is important, but let's apply it equally on both sides. And the United States is at the moment not doing that. That's why I stress that part of the peaceful package would have to be an agreement to have a referendum in those territories where you have a majority of Ukrainian citizens who are Russian speakers, and that referendum would have to be organized and supervised by the United Nations, not obviously by the Russian army as it was in the past.
And what do you think is motivating the West? Why are they not trying to promote more diplomacy or call for a ceasefire?
That's a good question. If you really ask top Western politicians this, I can only speculate. And I'm basing my speculation on published statements by some Western politicians, including United States Secretary of Defense, who obviously welcomed the possibility of weakening Russia, which he said explicitly. I think that is one of the reasons that they want to continue the war, because it will lead to a significant major weakening of Russia without the West losing a single soldier. The greatest price is being paid by Ukrainian soldiers and civilian population. So I think that this political motivation incentive is there. Secondly, this war makes certain circles of people extremely rich. If you look at the figures, I think U.S. has spent about $30 billion worth of military gear and weapons, outside humanitarian and other help. And therefore, for example, I can understand that the U.S. arms manufacturers are very happy about the situation. This is some of the greatest income they had since the Second World War. To a certain extent, this also applies to Europe, both so-called Western and Eastern Europe, including my own country, which exports arms to Ukraine, but of course not on the level and scope as United States. But so the motivation of those who make profit of this war and have influence on their governments is probably another reason joining the political one. And thirdly, I think the West got itself into such a situation when they believed that if they would allow Russia to win this military conflict, which I don't see it feasible, but I can understand that some Western politicians and even military people persuaded themselves that this would be a great danger, that certain countries on the Eastern Bloc of NATO will be threatened, including Baltic countries, and that it would encourage Russia to continue with these aggressive invasions and aggressive postures. I don't believe that's the case. I don't believe that Russia was, from the very beginning, motivated by taking over the whole of Ukraine, for example, let alone the nonsense that if they are not stopped on Donbass or on Dnieper, that they would then march into Warsaw or Prague. I think these are demagogic statements by some politicians. But I can see that it will not be easy to persuade everybody that a ceasefire and a compromise, which would allow the territory adjoining the Russian border to be free of NATO soldiers and NATO weapons and bases, that this may be perceived by some NATO fanatics as a kind of a defeat or as a failure, and they would like to avoid that. It became after the year also a prestige question, which is highly unfortunate because, as I said, countries and statesmen don't like to lose face. That's why I'm a believer in this constructive work of the intermediaries and states, powerful states like China, or Brazil, and the United Nations, India, and others, who would help to negotiate an agreement which would not be perceived as a defeat by one side or the other. But certain governments would have to curtail the ambitions of the arms industry, because for the arms manufacturers, this is the greatest income they had for many, many years, and they would be reluctant to give it up.
And then you have this kind of military-industrial media complex where you have people on the boards of arms manufacturers who appear as guests on the media, and they don't even have to announce that conflict of interest. And then you have this revolving door between people who work in politics and then go to work at Lockheed Martin or Raytheon and
exactly.
Don't have to reveal it. So then the media is also sending the same message.
Yes.
And are there any precedents for this kind of diplomacy ceasefire negotiation that you can point to as hopefully an example of something like this working when a conflict seemed inevitable or intractable?
There's no precedent for this type of conflict. At least I can't think of one. On the other hand, there were situations in the past when the world faced the possibility of a major confrontation and avoided it at the last minute. The case in point which I can think of is the Cuban crisis of the 1960s. At that time, it was also a clash of will between President John F. Kennedy President Khrushchev, or Secretary General Khrushchev. In my opinion, a common sense at the last minute prevailed, but it was almost at the last minute. The Soviets withdrew when they were even offered the possibility by President Kennedy that the United States will in short time, withdrew from Turkey, which again was perceived by Russians or by Soviets as dangerous because they share a joint border. And obviously, weapons of an adversary so close to their border, they perceived as a threat to their national security. I think it was then a smart diplomatic negotiations on both sides, which led to a highly acceptable compromise. And so that's a situation which, to my mind, is comparable to a certain extent to today. But I can't see of such a multilateral involvement of negotiators, which this would have to involve. This is not just, I mean, in my opinion, we are witnessing a proxy war between Russia and NATO. Without NATO's involvement, Ukraine will not be able to be as successful as it was up to now. So this is not a Russian-Ukrainian war solely. It's a proxy war between NATO and Russia. Therefore, it involves more countries, more armies, more politicians, and therefore it's going to be more difficult to put an end to it. But a diplomatic solution is the only possible. No, there is no alternative other than a major confrontation risking a nuclear holocaust. So in that sense, it's compatible with the Cuban crisis. And I'm quite surprised that those who remember the Cuban crisis find it difficult to imagine why President Putin and the Russians were so afraid of NATO troops in Ukraine. If once again you would have, say, Russian missiles in Cuba or some Russian or Chinese, for that matter, military bases in Mexico or in Toronto, I'm sure the United States would not be prepared to tolerate that and will respond in a similar manner as Putin did. It is sometimes important, and I think President Kennedy made that point, that you have to think or try to find your way into the mind of your adversary and try to understand how the adversary thinks and perceives the situation. You may or may not agree with it, but it's a fact, and you have to deal with that fact and be realistic about it. If not, then you really run a major risk of a confrontation. And I think today we are, I don't want to be a scaremonger, but we are closer to a nuclear confrontation than ever since the Cuban crisis.
Do you think that the frequent, at least in the American media, I don't know about the rest of the Western media, but there's a frequent comparison that's made between Hitler and Putin. Do you see this in European media, or is this mostly an American thing?
In some European media, and in the speeches of some European politicians, yes, not very frequently, because you can't erase collective memory of nations so easily. Obviously, people who don't like Russians or Putin or are afraid of what used to be perceived as great power of Russia and wanted to reduce that power, diminish it, immediately find the comparison with Hitler. I think it's a very bad comparison. It's the same thing as when in 2003 the Americans were trying to justify the invasion of Iraq without the mandate of the United Nations, which I remember well because I was president of the United Nations General Assembly at the time. Some of them also made the comparison between Saddam Hussein and Hitler. I think that's an equally false comparison. Hitler put forward a dangerous racist theory, which he used to justify domination of the whole of Europe and hopefully wanted to dominate the world. There is nothing in what President Putin ever said which would lead me to believe that the Russians had similar plans, aims, ambitions. Not only it's obvious from the performance of the army that they would not be able to do it, but I don't think that they never put any justification for that. Several times since 2007 NATO conferences, international conferences on security issues where Putin spoke a number of times, he always talked about the threat of closeness of NATO to Russian borders as a threat to its national security, which, and he warned a number of times that if that happens, we would have to respond. Although I didn't expect that they would invade the way they did, I expected that they would send troops to the two separatist republics and create a certain cordon sanitaire between their borders. They went further. It's their decision. But nothing they've done or nothing they said would allow me, and I'm not pro-Russian as such at all. I have absolutely no reason to love the Russians. I have no reason to believe that they should be compared to Nazi Germany or Putin to Hitler. And as I said, I have no love for them. My father was sentenced to 25 years imprisonment in the Czech Trump charges, Trump political trials in the 50s, which were organized under the supervision of Soviet advisors. My country was invaded in 1968, and I was forced to become an emigre. I was thrown out of my country. I couldn't study, etc. I have absolutely no reasons to be sympathetic either to the Soviet Union or the Russians. On the other hand, I have to reject these kind of purposeful, demagogic comparisons with Nazi Germany or Hitler.
It seems like that is something that has really penetrated much of kind of the American psyche. And I think what makes it so dangerous, besides just being ahistorical and a very bad comparison, is that the logical takeaway from it is that you can't negotiate because you couldn't negotiate with Hitler.
I agree with you. You couldn't negotiate with Hitler. But you can definitely negotiate with Putin. And in fact, already in March last year, the first negotiations took place under the supervision of Turkish president and the United Nations. So there is precedent. You can negotiate. And Putin made it very clear that he's prepared to negotiate because he's obviously aware that that there is no alternative. He doesn't have the strength to militarily defeat the collective force of NATO. Even if he planned to do that, which I don't believe is the case, but he made it several times clear that he is prepared to negotiate. He made it clear to the Chinese president, Xi. He made it clear to the Brazilian president, Lula da Silva. So let's take him at his word, and renew the negotiations. Some of them already started as early as I said, 8th of February, last year by French President Emmanuel Macron. So, it's obviously, either ignorance of facts or demagogy, to claim that, you can't negotiate with the Russians. Just the contrary. I don't believe there is any alternative to negotiations. You have to negotiate.
One final question, because I know you've been very generous with your time, and it's late there. But Europe is paying a higher price for this than Americans, obviously, because of questions of geography and economies. So what do the European governments want from this? What do NATO governments want from this continued war? Is it a question of the arms industry controlling these governments, or is there something else?
The arms industry is obviously playing a role. I don't think they play such a decisive role as they play in the United States, but they do play a role. You have to become aware of what is NATO. NATO is not an alliance of equals. One country is much more powerful than any other within NATO and is the main decision maker. At the moment, I can't see any European government, maybe the exception of Hungary, to a certain extent for different reasons, but none of the important, powerful European governments, none of them will risk a real confrontation with the United States administration. If there would be at least a hint from the United States that they perceive an alternative to the continuation of the war, then I'm absolutely certain that Europe will support it. This war is not advantageous for Europe. the sanctions hurt Europe more than anybody else, much more than Russians and much more than the United States. The war has an economic terrible impact on Europe. The economic and therefore social situation for most of our countries here is getting worse. And the governments try to justify it by reference to this war, which I'm not absolutely sure is correct to the last minute, to the last detail. But the war does play a major role. A ceasefire will definitely help Europe. But Europe is not in a position to rally the United States. At least current European governments don't show that courage and ability to resist. And therefore, I do believe that negotiations will start at the moment when United States will hint that they have no major objections against it. And therefore, I believe that a fertile soil for negotiations will be created by the end of this year, beginning of next year, because of the U.S. primaries. To me, I would very much like the ceasefire to stop, to be implemented tomorrow. But unfortunately, it will not happen. My major hope is that the U.S. elections will prevent the U.S. administration to continue to claim we'll fight the last Ukrainian and support Ukraine as long as it takes. I'm no supporter of former President Donald Trump. I have to say that. On the other hand, when Trump publicly says, if I'm elected president, I will stop this war in 24 hours, that's naive. He will not be able to do that. But as a slogan, it's a very powerful one. And I don't think that a Democratic president can challenge that slogan by continuing to say, we will fight to the last Ukrainian and support Ukraine as long as it takes. I think if people would then have to make a decision, electoral decision, between war and peace, the war supporters will be on a losing wicket. And therefore, I do believe that by the end of the year, the current U.S. government will come up with some offer of a compromise with some less belligerent talk, with at least creating space for the group of intermediaries which I mentioned, where I think China, United Nations, and Brazil will play a major role. It will be important if the United States would at least not stop that, if it will not challenge that, if it will not resist that, if it will give them space and time to see that the negotiations can begin to take place. Once the negotiations will take place, once the ceasefire is agreed upon, then I think it's only a question of time when the killing will stop and the peace will prevail. But I unfortunately believe that we may have to wait towards the end of this year. I'm no supporter of former State Secretary Henry Kissinger, because I didn't like his decision to bomb Cambodia, Vietnam, and all that. And I also have a certain memory. On the other hand, yes, some of his current analysis is definitely worth taking into account. And I think he's right when he says that by Christmas, the situation will be ripe for the start of negotiations.
And if Joe Biden wanted to, could he end the war right now?
In a way, yes. I think that if he says that, not that he will suddenly, from day one to day two, stop sending that he can't do for political reasons. But if he says what certain American generals like Mark Milley and or academics like Barry Paulson and others said, there is no military solution, and that he supports a possibility of peace negotiations, which will guarantee that Ukraine will have the right freely and democratically to elect its own government, that it will not become a vassal state of Russia. If he says something like that, although the most tricky question will be how to achieve the future of Crimea and Donbas. But I think if he would then allow United Nations supervised and organized referendum, then it's not against any principles of the Democratic Party I know. And therefore, he would have to find the courage to hint at that. If he at least makes clear that United States is not prepared to fight to the last Ukrainian, that they do believe in peaceful solution, many others will join very quickly. And therefore, it will not be solely on him. But given the specific, powerful and major role of the United States, I think the first step, moderate, careful, pragmatic, a first step towards creating space for negotiations should come from the United States. It may come from China and others, unfortunately. But to answer your question, if it does come from the United States, it will be a greater guarantee that it will work. That's a small remark.
Yeah.
I recently read an interesting article by American University professor Barry Posen, who observed that diplomacy is in fact extremely cheap. He said, apart from time, airline tickets, and many, many cups of coffee, which I remember as a diplomat, the main price is entirely political. It's difficult for some of the people to pay the political price. And that political price would have to be paid by both sides. But there is no alternative to it. And I do believe that we should resort to what Professor Posen called a cheap diplomacy. And in my opinion, there is no alternative.
Well, thank you so much. This was really great.
Thank you.
Thanks again for listening to The Katie Helper Show. If you like the show, please join the Patreon at patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Again, that's patreon.com/The Katie Helper Show. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. And as always, we remind you that this show could not happen without the support of our listeners. Our show is produced by me, Katie Helper. Brad Bloom is our audio engineer and an associate producer on the show. Our researcher is Joshua Bregman. And our theme song is by the band Cordova. See you next time.